to Fancy Town Crimes Podcast, a podcast about crimes in fancy towns told by middle-class broads.
All right, well, hello, everybody.
Hey, guys.
This is Megan.
And this is Taylor.
And it's Fancy Town Crimes.
Oh, it feels so good to be back.
It's good to be back. I'm not going to lie, like, it is nice to have a month to research because, well, who am I kidding? I still do it all in the 3 days before. But it gives me more time to think, to brainstorm. I do dabble into the research and like get a good foundation and then just all comes together.
I agree. I do a lot more watching of like documentaries and like coming across different crimes that I'm like, ooh, this would be really interesting to talk about. Ooh, this would be really interesting. And then I can like come up with something that I think would be interesting to everybody, and I'm not just like pulling something last minute and being like, this is the thing. So I do like that.
Always interesting to me.
Oh, thanks, love.
Well, I have some kind of exciting news.
Yes, tell me.
Well, my sister got engaged. And it was a very exciting family moment, I'm not gonna lie.
Yes, we're so excited for her.
So, for the record, love my sister. I know she doesn't really listen because true crime's not her thing. I do know a couple of her patients / former patients listen, so hey there.
Hey guys.
You'll have a good story to talk about in PT because I'm gonna tell you about how Colleen almost screwed up her engagement.
This story is so good.
I love this. So my sister is an amazing human. She's also very like, once something's in her brain, that's it. We're doing it. Like, if she's ready to go, that's a wrap. We're out, kind of a thing.
Yes.
So first of all, her fiance had showed me the ring like 2 months ago at this point. And I was like, so exciting. This is great. So a couple of months go by and we're over their house for a barbecue and I pull him aside and I was like, hey, sir, like, when are you going to do this? And no word of a lie, he looks at me and goes, well, I've been trying to do it, but she keeps fucking up all the dates. I was like, oh, spill the tea. So Colleen just kept like forgetting about different family vacations or different times she was seeing her friends or like whatever. So this poor man who's still marrying her, God love him, would plan these sunrise hikes. So they got engaged on a sunrise hike, right? Like, how thoughtful. Okay.
Very thoughtful.
And then she would be like, oh shoot, we like can't do it that day because I'm doing this or we're doing that. And he was just like, God. Ma'am. So he finally
messing this up.
He finally fixed his date. And I was talking to her the week prior, like literally the week before. And she's like, oh, you know, he wants to go on a sunrise hike, but I just think I'll be too tired. And literally I blurted out, you can just take a nap, because it's like, this poor man.
This needs to happen.
So they go on this sunrise hike. And you have to, also, me never getting proposed to on a sunrise hike. You have to get up at the ass crack of dawn.
Like literally.
Before the ass crack of dawn.
Yes. I remember when I used to go, when I was a very young teenager, I would go see the sunrise one time every summer up until I was like 17 years old. And you had to get up so flipping early, especially in the summer, to see the sun. And it was just like, no, thank you.
I'm going to go on record. I don't know if I've ever seen a sunrise because
I mean, it is impressive. It is beautiful, but it's exhausting. You need to go and sleep afterwards, honestly.
So they go, they're getting up like 3:30 in the morning, and they're starting to hike, and Colleen starts to not feel great. So they're about like halfway up. And she's like, I'm going to sit here and like eat a snack. Like, I'm not feeling great. Maybe if I just eat, I'll feel better. And so poor Tyler's like, okay, no problem.
Sure. Take your time, sweetie.
Yeah, basically. And so I guess too, he had the ring in his backpack, but the backpack kept like slipping or something on the rock. And he was like really panicked about it. And she was like, dude, can you like just chill for 7 seconds?
You're kind of freaking out and it's freaking me out. So stop.
Yeah. So then she says, I think the sun hasn't come up yet. She's like, I think I don't feel good and I'm just going to hike back down. And this man,
my gosh,
was basically like, granted, he said it much nicer than I'm about to say it, but I'm a drama queen. He was basically like, unless you are dying, let's stay and watch the sunrise. And
I'd like to imagine that that's actually how Tyler said it.
He didn't, because he's far too nice, but I'm sure he wanted to be like, sit down and wait for the damn sunrise.
Sit down and shut up.
Kills you.
Yes.
So then, of course, Colleen is like, what is this dude's problem? And I mean, she didn't say that to him either. I'm editorializing a little bit too.
I love this editorializing this situation though.
Because I can just picture this in my brain. So then, of course, the sun starts to rise and then he proposes and she's like, oh.
Oh my gosh, that's why.
And so when they called me to tell me, of course, she thinks like none of us are going to be awake. Like, I didn't immediately hear that she was going on a sunrise hike and call everyone I knew about
it. Yes, of course. Of course.
Not everyone I knew, but I called my parents and like, you know, you and other people.
Absolutely.
And so she calls my mom and my mom's awake and she's like, oh, I think you'd be awake. And then she calls me and she's like, I didn't think, I'm like, Colleen,
we knew this was coming. We've known.
So long story short, I told Tyler he had a 30-day return policy and it's almost up at this point. He hasn't returned it yet.
Wow,
so
like, Tyler.
I think it might stick. So
he's happy with his decision. Good for him.
But yeah, truthfully, like it was a true Schitt's Creek moment.
Oh my gosh. And I love it. I mean, like, honestly, if you're gonna have a proposal like that, it needs a good story. Every proposal needs a good story like that.
I feel like most proposals I've heard, it's been the girl almost messing it up and looking at this guy who's like panicked. And when men panic, they don't panic well and they come off as like mad. And then you're like, why are you mad about this small, insignificant thing?
That's why a lot of women think that their boyfriend is about to break up with them right before they propose, because the guy is just like totally freaking out.
Yes. So at any rate, very happy, very excited.
Happy for you, Colleen. So excited.
Yep. And she asked me to be, you know, the maid of honor. I was so shocked. I was not, but I was also very excited.
I was shocked.
She asked me in the most perfect way. She gave me a candle and a card that was all office jokes. So I'm going to be the assistant to the regional manager at that wedding.
Can that please be your title, like on her like wedding website? And in like the like, I was gonna say brochure, but that's not what it is. The pamphlet that they give out at the beginning of the wedding. Can it just say that that is what it, that's what you are? That would be ideal.
She's a little too formal for that, because like I made the joke. I was like, oh, Tyler's your ex-boyfriend now. Like, let's call him your ex-boyfriend. And she's like, I'm not calling him that. I was like, oh, all right, never mind. My bad.
Oh my God.
I mean, she wasn't mad or anything, but she's like, no. I'm like, Jesus, when I get engaged, I'm gonna be like, this is my ex-boyfriend. This, like, that's all I'm gonna do. Are you kidding?
As you should. I like it that way. I'm gonna start calling Jeff my ex-husband and ex-boyfriend and ex-fiance.
I was gonna say he's your ex-fiance. Just wherever you go. Oh my God, you should be like going for ice cream sometime. Like,
this is my ex-fiance.
He would be
mortified.
Jeff. His cheeks would be a rosy color.
He would be mortified. Oh my gosh. Poor guy. Poor Jeff. He has to put up with us.
5 years strong.
I know. Can't believe it. Oh my God. In like 16 days.
Yeah. You had a baby and got married in like basically, well, 4 years apart, but like the same flipping weekend.
Yep. Had Ellie on the 17th. And our anniversary is on the 18th. Literally celebrated our 4-year wedding anniversary in the hospital last year. We like ordered. I don't know if this is like normal at other hospitals, but where I gave birth, you got like this like ticket for like I guess it wasn't like a fancy, but it was like a one nice meal. And we were, and so the food, at the hospital where I had gave birth was incredible. Like
Because I've been there not to give birth, but I've been there.
The food is so, like, I would go to that hospital just for the food. Like,
the chicken sandwich was excellent. I think I ordered the chicken sandwich 3 days in a row.
I mean, girl, it's our favorite hospital, guys. But we ordered fancy meal on our anniversary in the hospital with our newborn baby. So they like rolled in this cart with like a white tablecloth and like all this like pretty dessert and food. It was excellent. The food was amazing. So highly recommend Winchester Hospital for your next meal.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Your next anniversary.
If you're out and about, drop right on into that cafe. Okay, so also I thought you had a tattoo that you didn't tell me about. Just 1,000 colors on your arms.
I was swatching. Can you imagine if I got a tattoo and I didn't tell you?
The entirety of Sephora? What the
hell? I know. I was swatching a Morphe palette. I was like, ooh, I don't know why. While you were telling that story, I was like, I really want to swatch a palette. So I swatched a palette, guys, and now I'm covered in it all over my arms.
It's nice colors. I do like it.
They're very pretty. I really enjoy them.
Shall we dive on into probably the fanciest place we'll ever go?
Let's go there, girl.
Dude, you picked, I'm sorry, the pinnacle of fancy.
I did.
Monte Carlo, Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yeah, girl.
So, researching Monte Carlo, I was like, I know we're always like, we have to go there, but we have to go there.
Amazing. Amazing.
I'm also kind of convinced that the Princess Diaries,
Genovia.
I'm like pretty sure it was based on Monaco.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Just because like, when we talk about it, like Grimaldi is the family that runs it. And they were, what were they? The Grinaldis.
That's a very good point. I never thought about that.
Oh my God. What was their last name? I can't remember it now.
Mia Thermopolis Rinaldi.
Rinaldi. I'm sorry. Grimaldi and Rinaldi.
I never knew that connection.
And also it was called Genovia, right? And we'll get into it, but Monaco before was called Genoese.
What? Okay, I'm reading all. I'm okay. Also, I just wanted to like pat myself on the back for literally pulling her full name out of my back pocket.
Oh my God, you weren't researching that?
No, I just was like, you were like, what was her name? And I was just like, oh, Mia Thermopolis Rinaldi, you mean?
Jesus.
No, I literally just apparently have that in my brain. It's tattooed on the back of my head.
Yeah, no, it was originally called, at one point, it was the Genoese. I'm sorry.
This is based on.
Wasn't it like a super tiny country?
Yes, it was. That is so weird. I think you're totally right.
Yeah. So anyway, we're going to talk about Monte Carlo.
Yeah, and girl.
Honestly, we're going to talk a lot about Monaco, because Monaco is so small, it was actually kind of hard to research just Monte Carlo.
Fair.
Because we'll get into it. It's tiny. So I got my research from Wiki, obviously. Wiki. And Business Insider, an article by Katie Warren. So Monte Carlo is an administrative area of the Principality of Monaco, which is a sovereign state. Monaco is actually the second smallest sovereign state behind the Vatican City. It's tucked between France and Italy, and it's only 28.13 hectares large, which makes it smaller than Central Park in New York City.
What?
Oh, yeah. It's tiny.
That I had no idea it was that small.
Yeah. So it sits on the Mediterranean, giving it a warm, dry summer and mild winters.
That sounds lovely.
Monte Carlo is home to the Monte Carlo Casino and the Monte Carlo Grand Prix, which is a Formula One race that goes through the city streets, which I've seen that before.
I have seen that also.
Yeah.
With like the really like crazy cars.
So a little bit about Monaco. Its name comes from the nearby 6th century BCE. Is it Phocian Greek? Do you remember?
Girl, I don't know. You're asking the wrong person.
It's Phocian. I think it's Phocian.
That sounds right to me. That like, sounds right.
I'm so comfortable until I go to read this.
I know the feeling. It's like, once you have to say things out loud, you're like, when was the last time I spoke English?
I'm like, what are words? I can't.
What are words? What are words is right.
So referred to by Liguarians as monikos from the Greek, which means single house or alone house. According to ancient myth, Hercules passed through Monaco and turned away the previous gods. As a result, a temple was constructed there, the Temple of Hercules Monikos. Because the only temple of this area was the house of Hercules, the city is called Monikos. It ended up in the hands of the Holy Roman Empire, which then they gave it to the, again, Genoese. That's probably like a semi-French word that I'm butchering, even though I took
no, I believe French. That's right. Genoese is, isn't that a grape?
Monsieur Couture would kill me, my French teacher. Hopefully he
can. Oh, Genoese. No, Genoese is a, that's what it is. For my fellow Great British Baking Show, Great British Bake Off people, Genoese is a type of sponge cake.
Oh, that also sounds good.
Yeah, it's, oh my gosh, amazing.
So the Grimaldi family took control of Monaco in 1297 and continue to rule to this day.
Wow.
So this family has roots, like I was reading on Wikipedia, because I got lost in a black hole. Their roots go back so far. I'm like, I don't even know some of my second cousins.
I mean, for real.
Because, I mean, truthfully, like, I love my grandma, but that woman can hold an Irish grudge like nobody's business. So sometimes people enter into our family events that I've never seen in my 30 years because she's had a grudge with them for 40. And she's like, oh, no, you know this, the Irish way. Oh, no, you know this person.
That is the worst when you walk into a party and everybody's like, no, you know who this is. And I'm like, I have no idea who this person is.
Literally have no idea who this person is. What are you talking about? Actually, so at my parents' 30th anniversary, which was a lot of fun, but I got their wedding video that was on VHS converted to DVD so everybody could see it. It was great and it was a lovely time. Now, my parents did not have me for like, I think I was born like 3 or 4 years after they got married, 3 or 4 years. So I was not there. This woman literally came up to me and she's like watching the video and she was like, oh, who's this? Who's this? And one of the women, it was one of my uncle's ex-girlfriends, and I guessed it one of the names that I had, heard previously.
Sure.
And this woman literally looks at me and goes, no. What? No. What are you talking about? Who is it?
Oh.
And literally, I'm standing there, baffled, and I'm like, lady, I'm 27. What are you talking about? I don't know. You were there. I was not. You were literally there.
I don't know.
And so then I threw out another name because I think, my uncle had dated this woman before I was born, but I had heard her name before. And then he dated another woman, when I actually came around. It's making my uncle sound so great. He wasn't a player or anything. He just had a normal sequence of girlfriends over time.
Dated people. But let him live his life.
I said the other name. She's like, oh yeah, that's what it's gotta be. How silly. And I was like, lady,
I wasn't there.
You were there. I was not.
I'm glad to know that that's actually an Irish thing because I thought that was just my family thing.
No, it's wild. You know these people. I've literally never laid eyes on them.
No idea who this person is.
God love the Grimaldis because they know people from so far back.
I can't even
tell you anything.
Nope.
Okay. Except we came over from Ireland. We eat a lot of potatoes. We have a lot of round, stocky figures. It's all good. Okay. True. <It's> true. So the Grimaldi family took control in 1297 and they continue to rule to this day. The current head of house, which is called Le Chef du Maison.
Oh, girl, that was great.
Little Maison.
Le Maison.
Gotta give a little something. Monsieur yep. Couture is gonna be very angry with me. but currently the head of house is Albert II of Monaco, sovereign prince of Monaco, who is the son of Prince Rainer III and princess consort Grace of Monaco, who was Grace Kelly.
Oh, I always forget about that. Yes.
Yep. Grace Kelly, who then became a princess. Goals.
Get it, girl. You get that princess status.
Been waiting around 30 years, but you know, whatever. It's fine.
Where's my princess crown?
I guess I'm not supposed to be a royalty. I love you, Brandon. Okay. When you think of Monaco, you obviously think of wealth, which makes a hell of a lot of sense because it's got the world's highest GDP.
Really? I didn't realize that.
$185,742.
Wow.
It has an unemployment rate of 2% and not a soul lives below the poverty line.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's wild.
The sovereignty is home to 12,261 millionaires.
Whoa.
Yep. Literally smaller than Central Park. Okay.
Whoa.
So in fact, in less than one, or no, it has the 12,261 millionaires in less than 1 square mile. And it has the highest number of millionaires and billionaires in the world, with 1 in 3 people living in Monaco are millionaires.
That's wow. Okay. I didn't realize it was like that rich. Mm-hmm. Holy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. So, it has some of the world's most expensive real estate. Shocking to know.
Shocking. Shocking. Yeah, exactly. That's not a shocker.
So as of 2019, do you want to guess how much a house cost per square foot in 2019?
Per square foot?
Per square foot.
Oh, gosh.
I'm gonna give you a reference. I'm going to help you out.
Okay, because I'm like, how big are these places?
New York.
Yep.
Which is also like one of the most expensive.
Yep.
Was $1,700 per square foot.
Okay. Okay, let's say, let's throw out like $3,000 a square foot.
$4,500.
Girl.
Oh, yeah. So
that's
of course,
wild.
Of course, I looked up a little real estate for us.
Because you had to.
And I'm going to drop the link to you because.
Girl, yes, I'm ready for it. Send it to me.
Everyone deserves this luxury. Bodhi is pawing at my very poor door, by the way.
Please let me in, Mom.
I know. So this is, I always go for modest, right? It's just a studio. In fact, it's in total, it's 40 square meters, which is about 450 square feet.
Okay, so small. Oh. Okay.
It is 2.1 million euros.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, 2.1 million euros, which I can look up really quick. Euro to dollar. But it's going to be like
a lot.
Flipping insane. So 2, 1, how many zeros do you need to do?
5 zeros here. Well, there's 6 zeros, but one
so
of those
that
zeros
is one. Oh my god, that's like 24 million here. No, is it 24 million?
What?
I wish they put a dot there.
Here, let me do this.
Hang on, I'm gonna type it out.
Euros.
2, 4.
Euro, nine. $2.
3.
2.4 million.
Okay, I thought so. Okay,
so instead of 2.1 million euros, it's $2.4 million.
Okay,
actually, that's a lot of money.
I said 24 million because I can't add commas clearly, but yeah.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. It's beautiful. Like there's marble, there's a beautiful bathroom, but it is 450 square feet with a galley kitchen.
Yeah, no, it's too, I mean, no, just no, I have to say.
But do you see the car that's parked in the,
yes,
the garage? Like all the cars that are parked in the garage, like, look at this parking space. It's a Ferrari. And a Ferrari that I've never seen before, which means it's like super rich.
Oh my gosh. That is just like, that's wild. That's way more than I expected. Way more than I expected.
Yeah. So like when I was like, we should go there. And then I was like, God, I don't even think I can fly in. I think I'd like evaporate because I'm too poor. Okay. So one of the main sources of income is tourism.
Makes sense.
Yeah. People flock to the casinos and the pleasant climate. I'm sure people also go to see the Grand Prix.
Of course. And to show off their wealth.
Interestingly, the Business Insider article that I had read said that citizens of Monaco are not allowed to gamble at the casino. It's exclusively for tourists. Yeah. Isn't that wild?
That's bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is there a reason?
I don't know, but it kind of makes sense now why everyone's a millionaire and billionaire there, because they don't gamble their money.
Yeah.
Interesting. So it's also a major banking center holding over $100 billion worth of funds.
So is Monaco, it like a what do you call it? Like a place where people hide their money?
I don't know if people actually have to hide their money there, because I feel like people just have enough. They're like, oh, you know where I would like some money? Monaco.
Fair enough.
Not like a Cayman Islands account.
Yeah.
That's who you're talking about?
That's what I'm talking about.
Where are the Cayman Islands?
In an ocean somewhere. Somewhere where I do not have my money.
Yeah, no kidding, right? Okay, so it's the only place in Europe that credit card points are not redeemable and hotel points are not accumulated.
Come on.
How am I going to stay there? I need to use my Hilton points. Maybe if Hilton sponsors us, I can stay there. Hilton, please sponsor us.
Hilton, we love you. I used to work at the Hilton. Guys, come on.
I used to watch The Simple Life.
Yeah.
Do you remember that show? That was
wild
back in the day.
It was. The 90s or the 2000s or whenever that was. They were a wild time.
Remember when we thought, like, Paris Hilton was dumb? And then...
And then
there was Governor Abbott.
And then there were politicians, and we were like, wait, I'm sorry.
And then 2016 hit, and I went, hold on. Am I on an episode of The Apprentice?
Am I the rest
of the country?
Am I being punked?
Where's Ashton Kutcher?
Ashton, you coming out to tell me, bud? We're still being punked to this day.
I call out Governor Abbott because that fucking abortion thing that went through.
Oh, my God. I can't even. I just...
Otherwise, I'd call out a ton of people, but that was the first thing.
Oh, there's so many to call out. It's like, take your pick.
Yeah, I know. Fuck that guy. He sucks. Okay.
Yeah, agree.
So, da-da-da-da-da. So, we can't use our Hilton points, and we can't use our Chase points either, which is a super bummer.
Such a bummer.
As of 2019, Monaco had the highest life expectancy of 85 and a half years.
Wow.
French is the official language. Italian, English, and Monégasque are also spoken.
Hmm.
Monégasque is a dialect of the Ligurian, a Gallo-Italic language.
Interesting.
G-A-L-L-O. I know it's like that kind of like ancient, for lack of a better term, part of France.
Yeah.
Gallo or Gallo? I can't remember.
I don't know, but that is very interesting.
Maybe Gallo-Italic language. Regardless, it's like that area where France and Italy kind of intersect. But Monégasque is considered to be the native language of Monaco. Monaco is made up of 47% French, 16% Monégasque, 16% Italian, and 21% other. They just They just couldn't be bothered to figure out that 21%.
Whatever.
It wasn't worth their time.
Nope. They're like, we're too rich for this.
Something like 75% of people who live in Monaco are not native to Monaco. Yeah.
That's very, I mean, I guess if you're that, like, what are the chances that you would be that well? Like,
it's probably a lot of second homes.
Yeah, for, I'm sure.
Yeah. So the drink of Monte Carlo is the Monte Carlo.
Well, hey.
No clue if it was made in Monte Carlo, like not a clue in the world. In fact, I found the recipe on this place called Kitchen Riffs. And they said they have no idea about the history of the cocktail. Its origins are a mystery. Our best guess, some anonymous bartender got tired of making Manhattans and decided to try this variation as an experiment.
Love it. I'm into that. I love an experiment.
A successful experiment, they say.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So probably wasn't made there, but very fitting because it's Monte Carlo. Yes. And if you like Manhattans or really kind of seems like anything with whiskey, this is kind of your jam. So this is from the Kitchen Riffs. This drink is a dressed up version of the Manhattan cocktail. Both drinks are made with whiskey, preferably rye, and bitters, but the Manhattan also features vermouth, while the Monte Carlo substitutes Benedictine liqueur. So the Monte Carlo is just a touch sweeter than the Manhattan with slightly more complex flavor. It somewhat resembles the Vieux Carré cocktail.
Of course.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Very nice.
Yes.
Traditionally, the Monte Carlo is served up in a cocktail glass. We like it that way, but think it's even better over ice on the rocks, like in an old-fashioned glass. So that's how we recommend making it. The recipe takes about 5 minutes to prepare and serves one. So the ingredients are 2 parts rye whiskey, a half part of an, half part Benedictine, 2 dashes of Agnostra bitters, or 1 dash of Agnostra and a dash of Pechard's bitters. Pechard's bitters.
Sure, that sounds right.
A lemon twist for garnish, which is optional, but this is Fancy Town Crime, so we always go with a garnish.
So it is required.
One day we should actually try and make these.
Can we, since we're doing these so far in advance, we really, really, really should.
Yeah, we should. We should give each other the town like way earlier, and then we should
start doing that next month. Next month.
Note to self, as I drink my White Claw. But
yeah. It's not a Monte Carlo.
So there's a procedure to this.
Of course.
You can't just mix it all together. Yeah. So you place all the ingredients except the garnish. I love how they have to say that. Oh, God.
They're trying to like stupid proof this.
They're like, listen, okay, here's the directions. So they place all the ingredients except garnish in a mixing glass half filled with ice. Stir briskly until well chilled, about 30 seconds. Strain onto rocks glass filled with ice. Add garnish and serve. And so we hope you will pause this right here and take a moment to make yourself a nice little Monte Carlo so you can listen and sip and enjoy.
Splendiferous. Well, thank you for taking us through Monte Carlo. I'm so excited.
I'm curious to see what you got.
So, okay. So we mentioned that we've been, you know, taking more time to research. And so one of the things that I guess technically it's research, but it's more just like for pleasure for me. But I have been obsessed with the True Crime Obsessed podcast. Like I have gone back and listened to, I don't know, like I'm almost through all of their episodes and they have like well over 200 episodes, but Patrick Hines and Jillian Pensilalli are so, 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 so funny. And so if you're not familiar with this this podcast, I would definitely recommend checking them out. But what they do is they watch true crime documentaries, and then they like basically just rehash the documentary and talk you through it. It's fascinating. So they're incredible, amazing. So highly, highly recommend checking this podcast out. I've been listening to it absolutely nonstop, and that's where I got my idea for this case. So it is, some of my sources besides True Crime Obsessed were a documentary called Life and Crimes of Doris Payne, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Crime Read, and History.
Wait, Doris Payne?
Yes. Did you watch this documentary?
No, but I think she was featured on Female Criminals.
I'm sure she was. She is fascinating Cuban.
I think it's her, but I didn't realize she went to Monte Carlo. Either that or zoned out while I was driving. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so excited for this.
So she has had a number of crimes, but I'm going to be talking about her most famous crime. So I'll give you a little bit of background on her and then the one that she's like most well known for. Highly recommend watching this documentary. It is so interesting. So growing up in the 1930s in segregated coal mining county in West Virginia, Doris Payne played a game she liked to call, quote unquote, Miss Lady. She'd don a hat and a purse and imagine herself living a far from her own impoverished circumstances. This ability to cast herself as someone else would prove a lucrative one and take her from a child playing pretend to one of the most notorious jewel thieves and career criminals.
Yes, I did hear this one. I freaking love this woman. She is so cool.
Fascinating.
I know she's a criminal, but she is really cool.
That's basically what they were saying on True Crime Obsessed, is like they kept going back and forth between like really liking her and then being like, but she's a criminal, but we really like her. But also like, Doris, what are you doing? So yeah, she's fascinating human. So over the nearly 70 years, 32 aliases and 9 passports.
Oh my God. Only in like what, the 40s and 50s could you actually do? Probably all the way up to like the 70s and 80s realistically, but definitely not anymore.
No, not anymore. So she traveled the world and stole over $2 million worth of jewels. So Doris has been arrested and incarcerated more times than she could count. She claims to have spent every cent of her takings. Her story is currently being adapted for a forthcoming film. So her story, they've attempted to adapt it into a movie a number of times. Like at one point, Halle Berry was going to play her in a movie and then that movie didn't happen. But she has like such, like, it's basically like Ocean's 11 style. Yeah. Like she needs a movie.
A pained one.
Oh, a pained woman.
A pained one.
And she was known as like Diamond Doris or something like that. So Doris was the daughter of a Cherokee mother and illiterate African-American father who beat his wife, which was terrible. So this experience seems to have had a profound influence on her, obviously. And she kind of used this as her jumping off point. So she said in a 2013 interview that when her father would abuse her, her father's abuse of her mother was worsening. And so when this happened, she boarded a bus to Pittsburgh, stole a diamond, and then gave the money to her mother to get her out of town and away from the father, which, you know, for a good cause. and she was 16 at the time. And that was really the moment that kind of empowered her. She felt like she probably felt like she had control over her life for the first time. So whatever it was that started her, she realized that she had a talent for disguises and sleight of hand. She was well-mannered, attractive, and had a knack for making people trust her. So for instance, in Europe, it could be as simple as wearing the right clothes. On another occasion, she had posed I never know what to say, like white or Caucasian, because Caucasian isn't a real thing.
She was a black woman. She was a person of color. So
yeah, she was posing as a white woman, as like a friend's private nurse. She was just like pulling things off all over the place. So to her, this was all very simple. Doris would visit the store holding a designer purse, dressed to the nines. And crime reports repeatedly would stress how attractive and model-like she was. So seeing the pictures of her, she was beautiful. So at the time when people of color were treated as second-class citizens, which we're not doing much better today. She explained in the documentary, people ignored her skin and took her manners in at face value, which I think
she
is really
acted like a rich white woman.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Actually, not to like impede on your story, but I do remember when I was listening about her, I think when she was a kid, she used to go into this like jewelry store and she knew the store manager.
Yep.
And he was always nice to her, except when another white person would come into the store, and then he was a total douche. And so that was kind of like her first real taste of, well, I don't know if it was her first real taste, but it was what they kind of portrayed as her first real taste as upfront racism. And she was like, fuck that. Like, this sucks.
Yep, totally. And so that story, actually, so she was in that store and he was like showing her a bunch of things. Mm-hmm. The white person came in and she still had one of the things like with her, and he like was shooing her out of the shop, and she still had this piece of jewelry, and she's like, whatever, I'm just going to take it then if you're going to treat me like that. And that was, I think, technically her first steal, at least what she describes it as. Mm-hmm. She's a very interesting person because she's very flowery with her storytelling. So it's hard to tell what's, you know, what was the first time, what was not the first time, you know, what it's a tangled web that she has woven, but nonetheless,
it's a colorful web.
It's a colorful web. I like that. I like that.
A few little extra pieces here, a few missing pieces, a
little
there.
Dash of, yep, exactly. So she always said you had to look like you belonged in order for her to be able to do the things that she did.
Fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm. So now she looked this part, then she would ask the salesperson to see a variety of specific pieces, which she'd move around with, you know, at a dizzying pace and sliding them on and off of her hands and wrists. Next, an item would mysteriously vanish. She would find it and then show the salesperson, and then she would win their trust by playing this game.
Well, that's smart.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, look, I found this thing. And then they're like, oh, whew, phew. So then she'd find some way to distract them, hide another piece she actually wanted on her person, say goodbye, and get out of the store. So that's how Doris did it. So now I'm going to talk about one of her most famous, infamous crimes that occurred. And I feel like you have to go watch Doris tell the story, because she just, the way that she tells her stories are so just...
I'm sure it's really entertaining.
So entertaining. So it's 1974 at this point. So at this point in her crime career, she was easily recognizable in the United States. And so she first thought that this would be a limitation for her being able to continue what she was doing. But she instead, she would figure she would go where diamonds make their first stop on the black market, to Europe.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I didn't either. I don't know how true this is. Once again, this is coming from Doris, so it's hard. Take this all with a grain of salt.
I'm drinking a grapefruit High Noon right now, and grapefruit is like not my favorite, but whatever, I'll take it because I like High Noon.
Is it good?
It smells like a candle. I don't
like, I don't know about that.
No, listen, like it's fine. Like I'm not a huge grapefruit person, so when I smell it, it smells like a very fragrant, fruity spray in the bathroom.
Yum.
That's all I can. I mean, it actually doesn't taste that bad. Like,
it's
now
like
that I say that.
It's like poopery.
Never gonna sponsor us.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm still drinking it. Like, I like it. High Noon, it's great, even though, you know,
even though it smells like a poop candle.
I mean, no, that was great. But, I mean, I do think it smells good. Like, I just want to keep smelling it. But anyway, okay, I'm sorry. Continue with Doris.
No worries, no worries. So from her studies during her West Virginia childhood, she knew that some of the history of Monte Carlo. So Monaco had royalty, and the country was home to some of the richest people in the world. She read about the royal wedding of movie icon Grace Kelly to Prince Rainier. Etched into her memory were the photos and magazines of the ornamental buildings that looked like royal palaces. She knew if she was going to begin stealing in Europe, Monte Carlo was the place to go.
Yep.
Yep. to prepare herself, she stayed at the Hilton in New York, where her partner in crime, who she called Babe, had and Doris had stayed numerous times. The staff remembered her and gave her the princess treatment. So for 3 weeks, she watched the women in Saks Fifth Avenue, read the New York Times every day, and studied Vogue to mimic the fashions and memorize the most valuable jewels. Doris entered Monte Carlo in that late summer, so 1974, the same day that Nixon resigned, and the same day that the first Black model, Beverly Johnson, appeared on the cover of Vogue.
Yes.
So when she got off the airplane in Nice, France, she knew she didn't have to worry about the police at the airport taking notice of her because of all the news that was going on that day. It was like the perfect cover.
This is why I could never, well, granted, I have way too guilty of a conscience if I ever tried to do something like this right? to eat me alive. But also, I don't pay any sort of attention to detail, like literally none.
I would have no idea that this would help me.
I would just be like, I would pick like the day that every cop is there. And then I'd probably still go through with it. And they'd be like, ma'am, could you like,
why?
Can you just like try and run a little bit? Cause like this was too easy.
This was too much. This was too easy. So she took a cab to Monaco. And she said it was so gorgeous to drive through the spaces of these
gorgeous.
The wide open skies above the valleys, the rows of the hills, evergreens, trees. So for the 30-minute ride, she experienced the mountains descending into the sea. And when they entered into Monaco, there were yachts with their masts everywhere. And it was just like, she was just overwhelmed.
Wow.
So
I would be too.
Right. So when she got in the cab, she immediately asked the taxi driver to take her to Place du Casino. So the casino, I guess. The casino place? I don't know. That's where she asked them to take her.
Place du Casino. I hope if you ever go to Monaco, you're like, Monsieur, Place du Casino, s'il vous plaît.
This is why Jeff speaks French when we go places and I do nothing.
It's actually Saivu plate.
This is why Jeff only, I do not speak when I go to France. I just smile and Jeff speaks for me. So it was in the fine shopping district. So this area had narrow and steep streets and shops on both sides, very similar to like San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And she knew just enough French to get by. So when they arrived in the shopping district, she realized that they had traveled away from the hotel and come back to the same area. So basically she could have walked, but going a few blocks on foot wouldn't have, you know, really looked right. Mm-hmm. Since she's like about to go and get some jewels. So she walked just the next few yards on the sidewalk. And there was a store that was jutting out the corner with wrought iron and decorative elements. So Cartier made the statement that it was the finest jewelry store in the world. Just before she reached the door, she noticed there was a poorly dressed American hippie that she had seen at the hotel, like walking on that street, and he caught her eye. And she became really curious about this person. This person doesn't come up again, but she mentions him a couple times. But anyway, so there was a female shopkeeper stepping out of the store and locking it behind her for her tea break. And she was about to approach her tea break. I could use a tea break. Mm-hmm. And so break time was the best time to switch things up and take what you needed. So Doris walked up to the woman. She said, "Oh my, are you closing?" And the woman turned to Doris and she saw, like, her eyes didn't question her at all. And it registered with this woman that Doris might have been like famous because she looked like so fancy, like she's a model. The woman smiled and she was like, "Of course, come right in, madame. Like, you know, we'll help you right away." So a young male server came to the door to welcome her off the sunny street. And into the chandelier light, there were velvety black displays of diamond necklaces and glass cases with black velvet tubes of diamond bracelets. She saw what she had come for, glass cases with big diamonds. So the only problem was she was the only customer, which would make things more complicated. So she decided that she would look today and then she would come back tomorrow. So the female shopkeeper made her comfortable. She motioned for the young man server to bring out a selection of rings. There were there was one glass coffee table where they sat and another taller table to Doris's right. So the server placed the tray between the woman and Doris and then went off for a second tray. So he knew the rules and knew not to put it down until he could swap it for the other tray. So he could always be in control of the jewels.
Mm-hmm.
That's when that American hippie that she saw outside entered the shop. So there was something about him that made her nervous. But that's when the server placed the other tray with five pieces on the taller table to go and greet him. This was a mistake because he now put the tray down and left her there. So Doris engaged the sales lady and said, oh, my husband's sister has a piece like this. It's so beautiful. You know, trying to make her feel comfortable, blah, 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 blah.
You know what's wild?
What's that?
The interesting thing is, like, I feel like it's such a power move whenever a woman is like, oh, my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is because when I was looking at houses a couple of years ago and I would go to an open house, if I wanted to be taken seriously, especially if it was a more expensive house and I like knew that maybe I couldn't afford it, but I wanted to look around, I would always say, oh, I'm looking for myself and my fiance.
Mm-hmm.
And you get taken so much more seriously. So that is such a brilliant move to mention that you're married because for, well, I mean, we know what reason, misogyny. Yes, and misogyny, patriarchy.
The patriarchy. Correct.
But you get, it's like all of a sudden it's like, oh, we thought you were wealthy, now you're like X amount more wealthy.
Absolutely. Now we trust you because you there's a man behind you backing you and helping you in your womanly ways.
Right? When really men are expensive. Like
they're expensive. Boys are expensive.
They're like guys. Orchids. They take a lot.
I know, a lot of energy and money.
Poor Brandon and Jeff. They're like really so low maintenance.
Like, hey guys.
I'm the orchid of this relationship.
Know, ditto.
A beautiful purple orchid.
I am a withering orchid. Someone massage my feet.
Brandon's the succulent.
Right, Jeff's totally a succulent. Oh, I'm gonna tell him that after. So Doris was watching every move that the saleswoman was making and that the other man was making. She was waiting for a gap to see when neither one of them would be looking at her. And that's when Doris reached forward and put on the largest diamond. So when the server returned, he was aware that there was a piece missing, a 10 and a half carat, $550,000 diamond ring.
Girl can pick them.
That would be worth $2.5 million today. Yeah.
Oh, Doris. Oh, yeah. You are. Mm-hmm. You're one of the good ones.
Yep. So he looked at Doris and smiled warmly. Doris pointed at the shopkeeper to indicate that she was still working with her. So she clearly had taken one of the rings to show me. And so he, or to show her. So he was about to ask for, he wasn't about to like ask her like, you know, where's this ring when mm-hmm. when it was like his supervisor was
doing
her job.
He didn't
want to
assault her. Yeah,
exactly. Like because Doris was like, oh, she's working with me. So like he like was like, oh, maybe she has the ring and like, I don't want to like interrupt. And like, there's lots of etiquette and oh boy.
Right. Plus I can see when you're working with that much money, the last thing you want to do is insult someone.
Correct.
Who will walk out of that store into one of the other $1 million shops down the line.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So at this point, Doris had to go. So she couldn't run out the door, but as long as they didn't say anything to her, she knew she'd be okay. So she goes, oh, my driver is here. There's more shopping to be done. I'll come for a piece tomorrow. Doris knew she had a small window of time before they would recognize that they had been robbed. So she quickly walked out the same door she had come in. at this time, Cartier was the premier jeweler in the world. I mean, I think Cartier still is, like, you know.
It's not doing bad.
It's Cartier. So they had been in operation as a family business in France since the 1800s. They are known for having, I didn't know that they were around that long, which is so interesting. They had made
jewels. When they were making wood rings.
They had made jeweled tiaras for King Edward VII and for receiving the appointment of a dozen and a half royal courts in Europe. So, like,
wow,
they had shenanigans. So for the first time in this, in their history, a woman walked into the store, was shown a selection of jewels, and had the nerve to walk out the door and go about her shopping.
And a BIPOC woman, no less. I mean,
exactly.
Again, no, she's a criminal, but the cojones took to do that.
For realsies.
Especially in a world when you weren't all that welcome.
Absolutely. So she did not take a cab. She walked the short distance back to the hotel, packed and headed by cab to the Nice airport. So her first mistake was her move in the store where she was the only person shopping. The second mistake was that she didn't change her clothes before heading to the airport. So now she's left a visual trail for anyone who came in contact with her. The airport was still bustling with the news of Nixon's resignation. So she was going to try and catch her breath, but she checked her ticket and it was a long wait. And so this was her third mistake. She waited. So she had $500,000 ring on her finger in the airport.
Even if it was mine, I'd be like, nobody look.
Yes, don't look at me.
Nobody, I can't check this. Do I have to check this? Like,
yes, seriously. I mean, the other big mistake, I thought I mentioned it in here, but I don't, maybe I come to it later. But the other big mistake is usually what she said is, you don't want to steal the most expensive thing. You don't want the thing that is like the most coveted. You want to, like, you know, get something lower down that they might not notice is gone. So another important thing that she learned that day, an international jewel thief has to get into the air, off the ground, out of the jurisdiction of where she stole, and get as far away as possible, as soon as possible. This didn't happen. So this piece was too significant. So when she arrived at the airport, police were there waiting for her. While in custody, she managed to pry the stone from its setting, throw the ring from her window into the Mediterranean, and sew the stone into her girdle.
Wait. Can you say that one more time?
She pried like the diamond out of the ring.
Threw the ring portion
into the Mediterranean, and then sewed the diamond into her girdle.
When the police were there?
While she was in, she must have been like, I don't know exactly how she did it. But she did it. She was held for 9 months and searched multiple times, and they were baffled. They couldn't find it.
Oh, this was when she was held at the hotel, right?
Yes.
Not a bad place to be.
Right?
For 9 months.
They never found the diamond. Eventually, she escaped and fled to New York City, and she sold it for $148,000.
Oh, my God.
So there was another story that I wanted to tell that I like was trying to find the full details of, and they talk about in the documentary, but it was another time that it happened in Switzerland, I think. She stole and she was extradited back to Switzerland or something. And they were like, okay, like, we're going to send you back to where you did your crime. We're going to send you alone on a train that has no stops. It's a direct thing. So the cops will bring you here, and then their cops will meet you on the other end. So they put her on the train. The train stopped for an unexpected stop for water. So she jumped out of the train and like rolled out of there and like made her way back to the US or whatever. Like, it's just wild. She's just so cool.
She's resourceful, that one.
Yeah. So Doris Payne, 83, in 2013, at an arraignment in court in 2013, after allegedly stealing a ring from a jewelry store in Palm Desert Beach, California. So a life on the run has not been an easy one. Yet for Doris, the rush of criminality was considerably a considerable incentive. It was a challenge, she said. The finer the heist, the greater the challenge. experiences of racism in stores as a child also helped rationalize these heists. It was a punishment, she said. In the back of my head, I said, take that. Even now, she struggles to find any real victim in her crime and says she sees herself as a criminal, but not as a criminal, but someone outsmarting a world that wanted to keep her down. Aging has barely dampened her fire.
Granted, she was in court at 83.
Right? A little over a decade ago, she told journalists she was through with theft. She'd since been arrested. She's since been arrested five more times, once while wearing an ankle monitor, and was most recently released from jail in September 2017 at the age of 86.
I want to party with her. Right? She sounds amazing. I just want to like go to her house, have a nice little glass of wine, or honestly, she probably drinks like vodka straight or whiskey or something like that.
Or like the most expensive like alcohol in the world.
And I will buy it just to be like, I just want to sit and hear these stories because you're kind of amazing. Because not for nothing, she's not wrong.
Yeah.
I don't want to say it's a victimless crime, but it is a victimless crime.
Yeah.
You Cartier has that insured.
100%. The only thing that I will say that I didn't think of when I was like hearing about her crimes is so the salespeople, they get in huge trouble when this stuff happens. Suck. Like a lot of them lost their jobs. She did say she doesn't feel bad for them, which stinks.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess you have to have that mentality and like,
oh yeah.
But again.
But yes, like the overall, like, yes.
That's not fair to the salesperson because working in retail, people steal. Like if I lost my job, fault. I literally one time turned around and the whole denim shelf was gone. And I'm like, who stuffed eight pairs of jeans in their pants? Like I didn't see anything.
Like, they actually just like put on all of the pairs of pants. So they got like one size up every single time. So it was just like, they just had really big legs.
Well, I mean, do is they come in with a shopping bag and that's what they do.
That's the way to do it.
Like if people lost their job every time something got stolen, like give me a break. We all know the reason that denim jeans are $80 is because it has to cover the cost of jeans that get stolen. And granted, like, sure, stealing a $2 million diamond, like, that's a lot of money. But you can't tell me that Cartier got, like, this massive hit because they lost $2 million. Like, I could steal Jeff Bezos's space dick and it literally wouldn't even make a dent in his, like.
So true.
I mean, it's.
So true.
It's honestly true. And by space dick, I mean his spaceship that he flew up in.
I'm sure
very much resembles male anatomy.
But I'm sure we all understand what you're saying.
But like honestly, like you could
so true.
You know what I mean? Like it's one of those things where it's like it's a drop in the bucket, you know?
Absolutely, 100%. So yet, given the opportunity, she said she'd do it all over again. In a documentary,
she Payne still
said
does. That
I know, right? Said she felt little remorse about her spectacular life of crime. She said, I don't regret being a jewel thief. She said, do I regret being caught? Yes. And that is the most famous crime of Miss Doris Payne, Diamond Doris.
That's amazing. I'm glad you did that one because I did really like listening to that one. And I was actually debating doing it, but I remember hearing that one, but I just didn't, it didn't click that it was Monte Carlo.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I was so kind of like, I wonder if Grace Kelly committed a crime. And that's why we're going to Monte Carlo, because that's all I think of.
That would be
that, Monaco.
That would have been very interesting. I would have loved to have covered that.
Yeah. No, but well, Grace Kelly was, you know, a gem, but
yes, this is true.
So for kind of funny / interesting.
Yeah.
We're gonna talk about the USS Zaka potential ghost ship.
Potential. Oh my gosh, my brain. Potential ghost ship.
Tell me more. So I kind of like pulled pieces from a few different sites to try and make sense of it because there wasn't a lot of information out there about a haunted yacht. But one of the places
I'm ready for it.
One of the places I got information from is called I Can't Believe It's Not Fiction. And it's literally the I Can't Believe It's Not Butter logo.
Stop it. I'm no.
Serious.
That is the best thing ever.
Type it in and you will find the I Can't Believe It's Not Fiction / butter logo. There it is.
Oh my God. This is incredible. This is incredible.
So remember when we believed fake butter was actually better for you than real butter? And now they're like, please stop with the spray butter. Do you remember the spray bottle it came in? And you'd spray it on toast?
I have recently seen it from some family members.
From the boomer homes, I've seen it too. Am I wrong?
Nope.
No, and actually, I don't think my parents have used I Can't Believe It's Not Butter in a long time.
Yeah, I don't think my parents have either.
But I've seen it in other places. So I also got info from Wikipedia. And then an article called Zaka, Errol Flynn's Haunted Yacht. And it's an article by Owen James Burke. So it would be helpful if I like pulled up the article. Wait, this would be helpful. All right. We are doing it. So before I read the article, which is the Zaka Errol Flynn's Haunted Yacht, I'm going to give you a little bit of background information about the yacht.
Okay.
So it was built in 1930, commissioned by a man named Templeton Crocker. It's a 118-foot schooner modeled after the Blue Nose, which was the fastest fishing schooner ever built. Yep. And the Blue Nose was in Canada. So Templeton spent much of the next 10 years traveling the world on his boat after he commissioned it. He was a scientist and left much of his research to the California Academy of Sciences. That is the dream. Being on a boat, collecting specimens, drinking martinis.
Yes, girl. So good. That sounds like that's the dream. Can we do that really soon?
It's the dream.
I want to do that right now.
So during World War II, I definitely want to do that right now. I just went back to work. I'm going on sabbatical, friends.
It's time for a break.
I had a literal 2-day work week this week.
Too long. That's too long.
It's too long. So during World War II, the Zaka was acquired by the United States Navy and used to rescue crews of downed American planes until 1944. And then in 1946, actor Errol Flynn purchased the Zaka. So Errol Flynn was an Australian actor and playboy, and he bought the yacht and commissioned it to be the most luxurious yacht constructed in her day. And for 10 years, laying dormant in a shipyard in the south of France, she was haunted.
She was haunted.
Actually, I'm going to send you the link so you can see some of the pictures.
I want to see.
Actually, it's pretty cool. Also, you can see from that first picture, he was definitely a playboy and also very much embraced that vibe.
Oh. Well, he was good looking, so.
I mean, he was, but like...
I mean, but smug.
He actually looks like a Nantucket.
Yes, he does.
He looks like he runs a business in New York City and vacations in Nantucket, but can't actually sail a boat. He just poses on it.
Yeah, I actually like him from afar, but then, you know, the minute he opens your mouth, you're like, shut that pretty mouth.
He opens your mouth.
He opens my mouth and I'm like,
even worse. Close my mouth, sir. Get away from me.
Close my mouth.
So the yacht was built to replace a 75-foot catch of the same name, which had been lost the previous year in Mexico during a revolution. Her keel, too large to fit in any shipwright shop along San Francisco Bay, was laid right on Main Street in Sausalito alongside the Nunez Brothers shop in August of 1929. So that's it was built in that time, basically.
Yep.
Okay. So we know all of the stuff that she did. Sailing to Acapulco, Flynn rented her to Orson Welles and Rita Hayworth for the filming of The Lady from Shanghai.
Oh, Mr. Okay, Welles, sure.
You've heard of that movie?
No, but Orson Welles and all these people, all these famous people.
So Mr. Wells did not return her until 1947 when Flynn was in Jamaica. Flynn, Zaka, and a Jamaican crew crossed the Mediterranean in 1950, finally resting at Club Nautico in Palma de Mallorca, where he lived aboard with his third wife, Patrice Wymore. Flynn passed away in 1959, years after drinking and self-medication with heroin. Zaka, too expensive for Patrice to maintain, began to fall into disrepair and was entrusted to English millionaire playboy Freddie Tinsley, who ultimately left it to Villefranche Boatyard to accrue storage fees beyond her worth. At some point, she was claimed for non-payment of rent and continued to sit and rot even further. The people of Villefranche claim that Flynn would walk the deck of the Zaka, now considered a ghost ship, at night, and the sounds of laughter and glasses clinking, by which it should be understood that he was always accompanied, were heard by the people throughout the town, until an Anglican Catholic exorcism was reportedly performed in 1979, from which point the sounds of Flynn were never heard again. So the story goes. So he was just like partying it up, and poor guy got exorcised. Like, I mean, it's not a bad way to spend the afterlife. I'm not going to lie. Partying on a boat.
I mean, if I'm gonna have to do that, like, it's definitely going to be partying on a boat. Like, I just, because there's.
If anyone's going to ruin the party, it's a Catholic priest.
You can say that one more time.
Okay, there are many lovely priests out there, but I growing up Catholic, I had to make that joke.
Come on, you got to do it.
So as of 2008, the Zaka is privately owned by Roberto Memo. And I didn't know what this word meant. I had to look it up. And birthed in Monaco, which means docked there.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah. Her winter port is in Port de Fontevieille and is often seen at prestigious sailing events in the Mediterranean, doing her thing.
Do your thing, girl.
In 2009, the Nautical Channel, which was then called the Sailing Channel, because we had to rebrand to call it the Nautical Channel, Compass More, they aired a show called In the Wake of the Zaka that detailed the life of the ship. So very interesting ship, potentially haunted. Priest came along, ruined the party, but you know.
What else is now?
I just love that, like, exorcisms usually think of, like, demonic stuff. Literally, this is the equivalent of a Karen being like, the party is too loud, but they're all dead. Come fix this. It's like this priest got enough noise complaints. He was like, fuck it. I'm just gonna come and bless this shit and we'll be done with it.
I love it. So good.
So, yeah. That's the story of the haunted Zaka.
That's incredible. Who knew? I didn't know that haunted yachts could be a thing. Only in Monte Carlo.
Only in Monte Carlo. For real. They must have like a noise ordinance there.
So good. So good. Well, this was probably the fanciest one we've done to date.
Oh, and I bet you it stays the fanciest one, because I don't know how we'll ever compete with a 0% poverty rate.
Yeah, that doesn't, I mean, maybe someday in a world, probably not, but one can dream.
Maybe one day when we're long gone, things will be great, but I don't see anything great in the next, like, okay, that sounds so depressing. I see a lot of great things. But I'm really hoping it shifts a lot to be like super great. You know what I mean?
Great. That would be great. I concur. Well, I think that was a good one. Thank you. Thank you for doing the haunty yacht. And
oh, thank you for choosing that crime. Doris is the bomb.
Doris is really cool. Definitely watch that documentary. It is The Life and Crimes of Doris Payne. Very, 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 very interesting.
Well, we thank you for joining us this month, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. If you did, please be sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. We've actually gotten a lot of likes on Facebook recently. So if you're one of those people, thank you. We love you.
Thank you.
My phone is blowing up.
I know. Ditto. I think people are catching up on our episodes. We appreciate it.
Super excited. If you guys have suggestions, drop us a line, fancytowncrimespodcast@gmail.com, or message us on Instagram, and you'll probably talk to me. And I love talking to people. So talk to me. And of course, if you like us, please drop us a review on Apple Podcasts and drop us a line, because it's super helpful when you guys leave comments, even if it's just like, hi, we really appreciate it.
It makes all the difference.
Yep. And with that, we thank you all and we'll see you next time.
See you in the next one. Thanks for listening to Fancytown Crimes. Our cover art and editing is by me, Taylor Adams. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Fancytown Crimes. If you have questions, answers, or recommendations to share with us, email us at fancytowncrimespodcast@gmail.com. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, basically wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you like this show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way to spread the news. If you'd like to show your support and get a shout out on air, visit our Patreon page to keep this podcast and the shenanigans going.